Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's show, we are discussing media coverage of one of the deadliest bombings in Baghdad since the 2003 U.S.-led invasion. A bomb-laden truck plowed through a shopping mall, killing more than 300 people and injuring more than 200 on Sunday. People are still searching for their loved ones in the rubble, and ISIS has claimed responsibility. ISIS has also claimed responsibility for a triple suicide attack yesterday near a Shia mausoleum north of Baghdad that killed 35 people and wounded 60. Also this week, a damning 7-year investigation was released in the UK, blaming former British Prime Minister Tony Blair of exaggerating the case to support the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Joining us to discuss coverage is Martin Chulov, an award-winning journalist covering the Middle East for The Guardian. Martin won the Orwell Prize for Journalism in 2015, and he has reported from the Middle East since 2005, and he joins us from Baghdad. Hi, Martin. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. It's always a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure to have you. Thank you. We're also joined today by Shane Bauer, an award-winning journalist and senior reporter with Mother Jones. In December 2014, Shane started work as a corrections officer at a Louisiana prison run by the Corrections Corporation of America, the country's second largest private prison company. And what he found was horrific brutality. You can read his piece at yourcallradio.org. Shane Bauer is also co-author of A Sliver of Light, a memoir of his 2 years as a prisoner in Iran. And Shane joins us in studio. Hi, Shane. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Well, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So, Shane, let's start with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I would pick a story by the Marshall Project. It was an investigation into for-profit prisoner transport companies. They got into a lot of detail about some pretty horrific conditions in these companies, of people staying in vans for days, packed in, traveling across the country. It was really good work.
How many days?
I think it varies. People that are traveling across the country, but they had stories of people in for, you know, a couple days at a time, just stuck in the back of a van, not able to get out.
So, like, people living in California who are shipped to another state and another prison?
Yeah, I don't remember what states they detailed, but yeah, it was going from one prison to the next. And there are companies that, you know, have a profit incentive, so, you know, less incentive to take breaks, more incentive to have more people in the van because they get paid per head, that kind of thing.
And you know about this very well because, as we said, you spent 4 months as a prison guard, and we'll talk about your story in depth later in the show. So kudos to the Marshall Project, and this is what they cover prisons very closely. Right?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do great work.
All right. Thank you for that. That's Shane Bauer. He's a reporter with Mother Jones. What about you, Martin? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
There was no one story that caught my eye, but I was impressed by the collective British coverage into the Chilcot report, which is a very important, long-awaited report into Britain's reasons for going to war. I thought that the British press did collectively a very good job in examining the report itself and harking back to the last 13 years, which was sparked by Tony Blair's decision to join George Bush in the invasion. And I thought there was just some rich, diverse, and appropriate reading on Tuesday and Wednesday, this week in particular.
So let's dive in and talk about that, Martin. What really stood out for you, and just to give listeners a little bit of background, so in 2009, Tony Blair's successor, Gordon Brown, ordered a public inquiry into the United Kingdom's support of the invasion of Iraq. Why did he order this report?
There'd been a lot of criticisms, and rightly so, since 2003. Firstly, about the decision to go to war. Secondly, how the occupation was managed. And thirdly, what contribution, if at all, a positive contribution, Britain had made. It was a subject that hadn't rested easily with the British public. There'd been an immense amount of pressure leading up to the decision to withdraw British troops in April of 2009. And that translated into political pressure. So Gordon Brown, who was not a full-throated supporter of the invasion, but was in the ruling Labour Party at the time, announced an inquiry into the reasons that were given to the public and used to justify the case made by Tony Blair.
In 2003, Tony Blair sent 30,000 troops to occupy Iraq as part of the U.S.-led invasion. 179 soldiers die. As I understand it, this report does not have the power to recommend criminal charges, but it's pretty damning. I mean, it basically says that Tony Blair followed President Bush's lead in one of the private and confidential letters from Blair to Bush. He said, quote, "I will be with you, whatever," end quote. What else stood out for you, Martin, as someone who has followed this for years? What stood out for you in the report?
It was more damning than most of us had expected it to be. It was an epitaph for Tony Blair's political career, no doubt about that. As you say, it did pitch him as servile to the U.S. president, but it was also very damning on the process, the decision-making process, which led to the invasion. It said there was no justifiable legal basis for it. It said that other options weren't explored, that could have mitigated the need. It said that the post-war management was awful. And there's barely anything that Tony Blair can take from this. This is really, in terms of a legacy, this is extremely damaging.
The Independent has a story today about how the families of soldiers killed in Iraq in the UK have vowed to sue Tony Blair for, quote, every penny. But what about the Iraqis? You have written stories about how they feel about this report. What did you hear from Iraqis?
Well, over the last 13 years, there's almost been a daily reckoning here. It's probably fair to say that the Chilcot report didn't really add to Iraqis' sense of what they've lost or in some cases what they've gained. It was, in their view, Britain's attempt to purge its conscience. There'd been many other times throughout the last 13 years where they've had to look for why, where, and how. This didn't really register, so much so that it was covered briefly, perfunctorily, by state media, but government officials that we spoke to on the day that the report was released, and it was getting banner coverage all throughout the UK, they didn't know who Chilcot was. They had no idea of what this report meant for Britain, because, as they said, there's been so many other headline moments here that we've had to take stock. This doesn't matter much to us.
And Martin, you interviewed Bassam Jaber Abayati, and he said this is the reason for all this chaos. They should have known better. They should have apologized earlier. The West should be accountable for all of this misery.
Yeah, that was certainly I should make a distinction between political leaders and those on the streets. The person that I spoke to was at the scene of this horrific bombing in the Karada district in central Baghdad that you spoke about in your introduction, where in excess of 290 people were killed, most of whom were burnt to death in the inferno that followed, not killed in the initial explosion. So this really has captured or shocked an already numbed or an inured public. It's in some ways galvanized an Iraqi street that has been polarized for so long. And it's fair to say that at that bomb scene, people were made aware that that this report had been released in the UK, and that was the prevailing view that, you know, how could they not have seen this coming? Look how they've left us. Most of them were Shias, the people we spoke to, members of the ruling majority sect, and some of those people may have done better under the American occupation than they may well have under Saddam, where for many decades they were sidelined and marginalized from Iraqi life. But nonetheless, they were saying to us, we wish we could go back to the old days. Things continue to get worse. We have no stability. We have no security. And our enemy can target us whenever they want to.
Martin, what are your thoughts about the scrutiny of British politicians versus the scrutiny of politicians here in the United States?
It's interesting. On this issue, I think there is a clear difference. I mean, the British public have been more or less, I wouldn't say certainly not universally, but there's been a majority dissenting view for the last 13 years against the war. So it had never sat easily with the British public at all. It was potentially a little different in the US at the time, but certainly Tony Blair has been regularly pilloried and derided over many years, and even ahead of the Chilcot report, he was persistently called to account by people from his own party, from the general public, and there was very much a reckoning awaiting him. I don't think we've seen quite the same sense of vehemence or anger directed at George Bush or those who made the case in the US. Sure, there's been a period of soul-searching there, but it hasn't been as deeply personal as it has been for Blair, whose legacy seems to be almost toxic now. For Bush, it seems to be slightly different. I mean, he's a man who's withdrawn from public life largely, but he certainly hasn't faced the scrutiny that Blair's faced over the years.
Shane, what are your thoughts on that? Why don't you think George W. Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney have received the same kind of scrutiny in this country?
The same kind of scrutiny as
Tony Blair, for example.
I mean, I think we've had, you know, this has been an issue that's been going on for a long time, where we've had these you know, these occurrences that many consider war crimes, and a new administration comes in and is kind of trying to set a clean slate and, you know, not look into the past. And that's different in the U.S. You know, I think we protest stuff differently than Europe or other countries have.
Well, you can read the report and also Martin's reporting at yourcallradio.org. And I also wanted to give kudos to Channel 4 News because they put a 3-minute video together of the faces of people who died along with what they did, dancers, soccer players, people who are going to university, just everyday life. They looked at a number of Iraqis who were killed in Sunday's bombing. It killed 300 people and injured 200. Martin, we have just a couple of phone calls for you. Let's hear from Frank in San Francisco. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was wondering, what is your guest's opinion of the question, what could the Obama administration have done differently to prevent the current chaos?
Martin, were you able to hear Frank?
I did hear Frank. Now, look, the key accusation that's thrown at the Obama administration, apropos Iraq, is that he withdrew too quickly. I would argue that isn't the case, in the sense that the decision which led to the withdrawal was signed into law by George W. Bush as part of the Status of Forces Agreement, which came into effect mid-2009, which started the drawdown to Iraq, and which was finalized in late 2011, I should say 2010, where the last U.S. forces left. There was no way that Iraq at that time, under the Prime Minister then, who was Nour al-Maliki, was going to accept one additional U.S. soldier in the country. It was made very clear by him, and it was also made very clear by Iran. There was nothing much that Obama could have done, even if he'd wanted to, and he sure didn't, to keep U.S. troops around. And even if that happened, if he'd kept some U.S. troops here, would that have made much of a difference? I don't think so. At that time, it was very clear that Iraq did not particularly want a strategic relationship with the U.S. There wasn't much that the U.S. had actually achieved in that 8 years, which was going to help keep that country united or rebuild it. So in the sense of what could Obama have done in Iraq, I don't think he could have done much, because what started broken was going to finish broken.
Well, thank you for calling in, Frank. Martin, before we let you go, can you give us a little bit of context here? What explains this ongoing violence? Again, on Sunday, Baghdad experienced one of its deadliest bombings, and then there was another triple suicide attack just yesterday. What explains this?
The essence of it is that Iraq is a multi-confessional state, certainly the modern state. Under Saddam Hussein, the Sunnis, who were the minority sect in this country, had almost absolute power. Saddam was a Sunni, and he built the state structures using predominantly Sunnis, but not exclusively. They were ousted when Saddam was ousted, and the majority sect, the Shias, came into power. Now, very quickly, that power vacuum was added to by Iran, who were doing all they could to actually assert their influence, Iran being Persian Shia, into Iraq, and they very quickly allied with certain elements of the Iraqi governments and various manifestations of them. So from that point onwards, it became a disenfranchised minority Sunni sect saying that we've lost everything, and a majority Shia sect saying that we're consolidating power here and we're allying with Iran in order to do so. So that said, two sides of a virulent insurgency. At the same time, there was the U.S. occupation, which was taking place from 2003 onwards, which both sides were therefore fighting. But as the U.S. have now withdrawn, it's basically the two main sects of Islam at each other, using Iraq as an arena for power and as a battle for power and influence in the center of the region.
And what is the mood like in Baghdad? The images are just horrific. So much pain, so much anger, and people are really angry with the government because of rampant corruption. Can you talk just briefly about the mood in Baghdad?
It's one of despair. It is one of desperation, as you say. It's very polarized. There are two sides of the Tigris River here. The Shias live mainly on one side, and the Sunnis live on the other. And in the deepest depths of the sectarian war, the two didn't really meet. That changed for a few years. It's drifted away in the last three or four as the ISIS insurgency has taken hold in central and northern Iraq. There's a lot of pretending that the city is getting by, that it's functional, but the tensions run very deep, and it's going to be difficult to see how you can put the city or this country back together again.
Well, Martin, we have to do an entire show about what's happening in Iraq, but thank you as always for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Martin Chulov is an award-winning journalist covering the Middle East for The Guardian. He has reported from the region since 2005. He was joining us from Baghdad, and you can read his reporting at yourcallradio.org. And now we are going to spend the rest of the hour with Shane Bauer, an award-winning journalist and senior reporter at Mother Jones. Shane worked as a corrections officer at a Louisiana prison run by the Corrections Corporation of America. It's the country's second largest private prison company. He got this job in December 2014, and he had it for 4 months. And what he found was very insightful, but also very disturbing. So, Shane, before we dive in and talk about how you got this job and your experience, first, let's just give us a sort of private prison 101. How big are these private prisons? How many of them are across the country?
Sure. There's a number of companies that operate prisons in the United States. The two largest companies are the GEO Group and the Corrections Corporation of America. CCA, the Corrections Corporation of America, runs more than 60 prisons, and GEO Group runs even more than that. CCA brings in $1.9 billion in revenue every year. The CEO makes $3.4 million a year, which is 19 times higher than the federal director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. They run state prisons, federal prisons, immigrant detention centers, and these companies have been running prisons basically since the early to mid 1980s.
And how do states and politicians decide whether or not to enter into a relationship with these private prisons?
Well, a lot of them started in the 80s during and the early to mid 90s during a prison boom that, you know, this country was undergoing. The population of our prisons just rose dramatically, kind of, you know, partially as a result of the war on drugs, partially because we were issuing longer sentences. We were mandating that prisoners had to serve more of their sentences than they had in the past. And prisons were becoming overcrowded. So CCA was the first company to step in and say, we can house these prisoners for you, relieve some of the overcrowding, and do it cheaper. And today, the main argument is that they save the state and taxpayers money. So it's kind of a cost-saving measure.
And is the relationship between the state and the prison still dependent upon the state basically promising that they will keep the beds full?
That is a common stipulation in the contracts. The prison I worked at, I think the mandated occupancy rate was 96%. It might have been a little more than that. And if the state does not fill that number of beds, then they have to, you know, to pay for it, pay the company anyway.
And so you worked in Louisiana. Louisiana has the highest incarceration rate in the world, more than 800 prisoners per 100,000 residents. Is that why you chose Louisiana?
Well, I sent the application to prisons all over the country. I basically filled out an application on the corporate website, clicked some boxes next to prisons to send it for. I kind of chose them randomly and frankly didn't really think any of them were going to call me back. And I did interviews with a number of prisons, and ultimately I was in an unexpected position that I was able to choose what prison I wanted to take a job at. So, yeah, part of my interest in Louisiana was that not just the private prison company, but that it was, the place that had the most prisoners per capita than anywhere in the world.
There's quite a bit of media coverage about the private prison industry. When Bernie Sanders was running for president, he talked about it a lot. Mm-hmm. But as a journalist, it's really hard to get access.
It is, yeah. I think the coverage that we see, there's been some coverage in the presidential debates, and we see coverage when there's kind of an explosion, like a riot, or there was some years ago in Idaho, a CCA prison was closed down following an FBI investigation into understaffing and high levels of violence. But it's hard to get information from them. A lot of public records laws don't apply to private prisons because they're companies. They're not, state institutions. So it's hard to get records. It's, hard to get inside. People that reporters that do get inside generally get carefully scripted tours. So we haven't been able to get a real look at what life is like inside of these prisons for the 3 decades they've been in existence.
And that's why you decided to apply.
Yes, exactly.
And you were completely honest on your application.
Yeah, I filled out the application truthfully, used my real name, personal information, put down my current employer, the parent company of Mother Jones, the Foundation for National Progress. And when I did the interviews, they didn't ask me about my job history. They didn't ask me why I wanted to work in a prison. They didn't. Prison barely came up. It was kind of just generic questions about, how I work with others and things that, you might get asked if you were applying for Walmart or something.
So it was relatively easy to get this job?
It was very easy. It was surprisingly easy, yeah.
And it paid $9 an hour?
$9 an hour.
And what were your main duties?
Well, I was stationed in a general population unit. So this is a unit of 350 prisoners in a prison that holds 1,500 inmates. They live in dormitories of 44 men each. So it's a building that has eight dorms. And I was a floor officer, which meant that I was the person that would, lock and unlock the gates. I was the main person, along with one partner who interacted with prisoners, sent them to chow. I was supposed to, search the tiers, do security checks, things like that.
How much training did you get for that kind of work?
I went through 4 weeks of training, although many of the days in these 4 weeks were, literally sitting in the classroom with other cadets and doing literally nothing. There were no teachers sometimes. Some days we would get kind of read policies from a book or watch some videos. There were things that surprised me about the training itself. I mean, we were taught what to do if we saw inmates fighting or stabbing each other, and we were told that our job was to verbally tell them to stop. We were not to get in the middle of it. We were to verbally tell them to stop and call on the radio for backup. But the instructor said to us, we're not going to make enough money to get in the middle of something like that. And he said, if these fools want to cut each other up, then happy cutting.
I mean, that's the one thing that struck me. I heard the piece that you did with Reveal, mm-hmm. and it just, you had a watch where you were able to record the sound, and it just felt like it was consistent violence and shouting and fighting every single day.
It was a really chaotic place. I mean, prisoners who had been to other prisons in the state would say things like, Wynn has no structure. They would complain about the lack of security there, the lack of rehabilitative programs. I mean, there were days that I showed up for work, the beginning of shift, that I would go to a morning meeting and count how many officers were showing up to work. And there were days that there were 24, 25 officers for a 1,500 inmate prison. Mm.
Today we are speaking with Shane Bauer, an award-winning journalist and senior reporter with Mother Jones. In December 2014, Shane started working as a corrections officer at a Louisiana prison run by the Corrections Corporation of America. And he was in a town called Winfield. 4,600 people live there, 3 hours north of Baton Rouge, where Alton Sterling was killed. We had a show about that yesterday. And we learned that 38% of the households in Winfield live below the poverty line. The median household income is $25,000. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KLW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll-free number. You can also send an email to feedback at yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, it's Invisibilia, inflection point, that is. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with the nation's Mark Hertzgard about his new book, Bravehearts, Whistleblowing in the Age of Snowden. He says whistleblowers deserve our attention and understanding for preserving the foundations of a democratic society. So we'll talk about some of the most influential whistleblowers of our time. We will also get an update on Chelsea Manning, who just 2 days ago was rushed to a hospital after a suspected suicide attempt. And that is on Monday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined by Shane Bauer. He's joining us for our media roundtable. He's a senior reporter with Mother Jones. And Shane wrote a very lengthy piece about the 4 months that he spent working as a corrections officer at a Louisiana prison run by the Corrections Corporation of America. This is the country's second largest private prison company. And if you have any questions for Shane, if you read his story, if you heard that piece on Reveal, what did you think? What questions do you have? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So again, Louisiana has the highest incarceration rate in the world. And as you report, Winfield, where you were working, is a town of 4,600 people, 3 hours north of Baton Rouge. Baton Rouge is making national headlines because of the killing of Alton Sterling, who was selling CDs in front of a convenience store. Very, very high poverty rate. And in Winfield, you report that 38% of the households live below the poverty line, about $25,000 a year. Can you talk about the importance of poverty when we're talking about the issue of private prisons and the killing of Alton Sterling?
Yeah, I mean, when I went into this, I became a guard because it was the only way to get inside. I wanted to see what conditions were like for prisoners, and I was quickly surprised about the lives and the situation of the guards. Most of the guards were just poor people from the town who were desperate for work. They took a $9 an hour job that was very dangerous. There were a lot of single moms that were guards, a lot of kids right out of high school. And I saw that the line between prisoners and guards was very thin. I mean, they were mostly essentially from the same socioeconomic class. Some of them knew each other from childhood. There was one guard who had been a prisoner himself for 7 years. There was a lot of conflict, for sure, between the guards and prisoners. But I also saw a lot of moments of camaraderie and a kind of shared frustration about the company. That was kind of a point of connection between the guards and prisoners, as they generally felt in some way exploited by the company.
Mm-hmm. Because in many towns, you have options of fast food, Walmart, military.
Right.
Or in this case, a prison.
Yeah, I mean, the other main employers in the town were Walmart and the lumber mill, and Walmart would not give full-time employment, so people couldn't qualify for benefits. So if you're, you know, a single mom, for example, the opportunity to make another, you know, 50 cents an hour and get some kind of limited health care is appealing, even if the job is, you know, way more dangerous.
What did you hear from the guards about the brutality and the violence that they experience on a daily basis?
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a really high turnover at Wynn, and guards that I worked with later quit, and I spoke to them afterwards, and they told me they quit because they just felt like you know, they were in danger, and that if it was just a matter of time before they got hurt. I found later through public records requests that during the first 2 months of 2015, which is a period that I was there, there were around 200 weapons found at Wynn. That was 23 times more than the maximum security Angola prison. And, you know, part of the issue was that there was so little staff and the morale was so low among guards that guards didn't really do security checks. You know, they would just kind of come in, clock in, and my work partner said to me, I feel like I'm just a body to them. I just come in and do the bare minimum. And, you know, that led to increased number of shanks, you know, prisoners. There were some predatory prisoners or other prisoners that felt they needed to protect themselves because they didn't have security any other way.
Hmm. Let's talk about the prison population. You report that 75% is black,
right.
25% white or mm-hmm. other. The average age of the inmate, 36. Mm-hmm. Average sentence, 19 years.
Yep.
Average time served, almost 6. And then violent crime, 55%. Drug crimes, 19%. Property crimes, 13%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a medium security prison. So there was really a huge range of people that were there. There were some that, you know, were in prison for murder and some that had too many DUIs that were there for a year or two. So it was a real mix.
I mean, 4 months as a prison guard, your experience with the prisoners varied and changed
yep.
over time. And,
mm-hmm.
I mean, this really got to you
yep.
mentally and emotionally. How were you able to get the stories of the prisoners? Did you have the ability to really talk to them and ask them about their stories?
I did spend a lot of time talking to prisoners, some more than others. And there's one prisoner that I write about in the story who I call Corner Store, who had been there for nearly 20 years. And, you know, he would have no problem kind of talking to guards. A lot of prisoners avoided talking to guards. And then there was some that I just had, you know, all-out conflict with. But it was a challenge, you know, of the approach because I was a guard. You know, had I been a prisoner in that prison, I would have had a totally different view and would have had very different conversations with prisoners. But there was a lot of, you know, kind of downtime that I would, you know, stand at the bars and talk to people just about their lives and their experience there.
What does this experience do to someone who's never been behind bars? Someone who is stopped for marijuana, for example, and then they're thrown into this environment.
I mean, I can only imagine, but I mean, there were people that I saw who went there who I didn't necessarily know a lot of their crimes, but, you know, people who kind of show up that seem that, you know, might be their first time, they're very nervous, and those people have a really hard time, and there was a lot of sexual violence in the prison, and these new first-time prisoners are particularly at risk, especially if they're young, and, you know, people would fall into these kind of relationships of sexual servitude where they would be kind of tied to one man who claimed them.
That's the other thing that really got me about this story was the sexual violence and the rape.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I saw one prisoner get beat up by what is called his old man, the guy who kind of the dominant person in that relationship. He was beaten badly with a lock and a sock, and he had just come out of solitary confinement himself, and when he was faced with the option of going back into the dorm where this man lived and his friends lived, or going into protective custody, which was solitary confinement, he wanted to risk living in this dorm where he could have been, you know, raped or stabbed. And it was, you know, really brought home how difficult the conditions of isolation are when you're choosing that.
What is the response of the guards? I mean, they know this is happening.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, I think overt violent rape was something that, you know, was never accepted, and if it was ever caught, they would definitely react and there would be consequences. But this kind of more systemic issue that occurs in prisons throughout the United States isn't only an issue of private prisons, of what are called punks in prison, these people that are in these kind of more, you know, subtle relationships, you know, of kind of bondage, that was largely accepted at Wynn, and I never saw anybody kind of get, you know, in the way of those relationships.
You report that 66% of incidents of sexual misconduct by prison staff involve sexual relationships with inmates who appear to be willing, according to authorities. Former inmates of private state prisons are half as likely to say they've been sexually victimized by another inmate as those who were in public state prisons. However, they are twice as likely to report being sexually victimized by staff.
Yeah, I mean, I saw... well, in prison, you know, any sex between staff and prisoners is classified as rape, whether it's consensual or not. And there's a whole issue of can that ever be consensual? There's such an extreme power dynamic. But it was not uncommon for guards and prisoners to have sex in this prison, especially with the women guards. This is a male prison, and, you know, their women would have sexual relationships with men, as would male guards. You know, it's very complicated. You're essentially living in this place as a guard, you know, not 24 hours a day like the prisoners are, but you're spending a lot of your waking life with them, and... you know, that can develop into a situation where you become very hardened and hostile, but it can also go the other way. You end up relating a lot to the people you're with.
And we're talking about a major power dynamic here, because you just reminded me of an investigation out of Florida about sexual assault in jails there. And this was a women's prison.
Yep.
And they said in order to get basic things like tissue and toilet paper, they had to have sex with guards. Otherwise, they wouldn't get just basic necessities.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the power dynamic at a place like Wynn is complicated. Guards, I did not feel like I had power there. I felt like I was trying to figure out how to make it through the day. And, you know, I was a male guard. For a female guard, it's a very different situation. And I did see a lot of sexual assault going the opposite direction, you know, prisoners masturbating at women guards is a very common issue. You know, so there's different ways that I think different people in the prison had power, but it was hard to point to one side having absolute power.
Shane Bauer is a senior reporter with Mother Jones. In December 2014, he worked as a corrections officer at a Louisiana prison run by the Corrections Corporation of America, the country's second largest private prison. And he worked in the Wynn Correctional Center, and it's in a town called Winfield, 4,600 people, 3 hours north of Baton Rouge. 38% of households in Winfield live below the poverty line of $25,000 a year. And if you have any questions for Shane, if you'd like to talk about reporting on these private prisons, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio, or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So what was it like for you to be a guard and a journalist? Because you were taking notes, mm-hmm. you were recording sound, and, I mean, you saw so much violence, mental abuse, riots. Mm-hmm. How did that experience affect the way you decided to report the story?
It was really challenging. I mean, when I went in, I initially felt like, especially when I was in training, like I was a reporter with a guard suit on, and it felt almost like a costume. But once I started the job, it, you know, was immediately apparent that I was a guard. I wasn't acting as a guard. I was a guard. I was in the prison. And a lot of my energy had to be focused on how to do that job. I mean, everybody who started that job is kind of floundering. The training, as soon as you start the job, the training feels inadequate, almost irrelevant. And you're just constantly challenged and constantly trying to figure out who's being truthful to you, who's manipulating you, what are the dangers. And, you know, I was always stepping back, taking notes, writing about the experience. But over time, more and more of my energy became focused on the kind of conflicts I was enmeshed in, and a need to kind of maintain authority. I mean, I became a part of that system. I was, a guard like everyone else there was. There was no difference, really.
When you read your article or look at your notes, what stands out for you just in terms of how you changed? Because mm-hmm. we were talking before the show about the Stanford prison experiment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think it was 10 students were involved in this. 5 were prisoners, 5 right. were guards. Within something like 24 to 48 hours, those guards really took advantage of their power
yep.
and treated their fellow students, prisoners, with violence and anger.
Yep.
And I mean, it was amazing to read about. And there was a movie done right. about this, and it was really frightening to watch.
Yeah.
Well, how did that affect you?
I thought a lot about the Stanford prison experiment while I was there. I felt like I was kind of living it in some way. And, you know, one of the things that was surprising the most to me is that I was aware of this going in. You know, I knew about this experiment, for example. I was constantly reflecting. I saw myself changing and would write about it. But I still couldn't stop it, you know. When I would go into the prison, it was like I was a different person, and I would come out and I would kind of be back to my old self, but I couldn't be myself in there. And I think that, you know, it speaks to what people like Philip Zimbardo talk about and what they find, that, you know, we are very much shaped by our circumstances, and this, we have an idea of who we are as individuals, and many of us believe that there is this kind of core self that is unchanging, but it's, you know, you put yourself in a radically different situation and you will become a different person. And, you know, that was startling to me and frightening, really. And, you know, I think the reality is in that prison that's so chaotic, and there's just not enough staff to run it in a way that would seem in any way reasonable. You know, you're just out for yourself. Everybody in that prison is out for themselves, and you have to play that game. And if you don't, you're going to be thrown under the bus.
Well, and you knew that you had a life back here in the Bay Area.
Right.
But what about those guards who leave and only have an option of Walmart, fast food, or the military?
Yeah. I mean, I thought about that a lot when I left. I just took off and hopped on a plane and was back in California. And this is something that they could never do. I mean, their decision to quit is a much harder one. You know, they're living paycheck to paycheck, and they quit this job, it's a big risk.
And then what about the prisoners who are right. cycled in and out of yep. this violent system?
Yep. Yeah, they have no choice, obviously. I mean, they could end up there for years. And, I mean, there was just constant frustration from prisoners about just basic things like they're wanting to take a class and, you know, a lot of the programs over the years had been cut, but the ones that did exist often would be canceled because there was nobody to run them. They, you know, couldn't get out to the yard sometimes because there wasn't staff. The prison would get locked down, and they would be frustrated because they felt that this was an issue of management. I mean, I was surprised to hear prisoners say things like, they need to give you guys raises so that the situation here is better. They need to hire more guards. You know, I would never expect to hear that from a prisoner.
And they had nothing to do all day
because
of budget cuts.
Some people, you know, there were limited programs and some, you know, worked in the cafeteria or something, but it was very limited. So a lot of the guys were just sitting in their dorm all day outside of, you know, chow time. They'd go to the cafeteria. But, you know, they're a warehouse, essentially.
And the reason why there weren't enough staff is because of profit?
I mean, this is the core contradiction, you know, when we talk about private prisons. These companies have a responsibility to provide care and security and, you know, rehabilitation to the prisoners, but they also have a responsibility to make a profit. You know, their stocks are traded on Wall Street, and the main way that they, save money is through, you know, they cut costs like any other company does, and it comes down to staffing. Staffing is about 60% of the cost of running a prison. So if you, pay guards less, have less people working, then you make more money. But there are a lot of consequences that come from that. I mean, I saw a man, there was a man that escaped while I was there that just climbed over 2 fences in the middle of the day and nobody saw it happen. He was in view of the guard towers, but there were no guards in the towers. The company had cut those positions and replaced them with cameras.
Shane Bauer is a journalist at Mother Jones, and in December 2014, he started work as a corrections officer at a prison in Louisiana, the Corrections Corporation of America's Wynn Correctional Center. And you can find his story at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet at Your Call Radio. And let's hear from Karina in San Francisco. Hi, Karina. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I just had a quick question. I know, thank you for doing this article. I lived in Louisiana for a long time, but I'm in SF now. And I had a quick question about whether the prisons there provide contraceptives or if they're still illegal, because I know in many states they have been. In San Francisco, I think they just became legal in the prisons, but in a lot of states they've still been like contraband. So I wondered if you knew about that.
I mean, I can't speak for the whole state, but at Wynn there were definitely no contraceptives, and any sex between prisoners would be punishable. You know, they would go to segregation, which is essentially solitary confinement, or, you know, in a lot of cases, people would be double-celled in 8x8-foot cells, but there was no tolerance for any kind of sexual relationships.
Well, thank you for calling in. What about organizations that advocate for prisoners? Do those exist in Louisiana like they do in California? I mean, there are amazing groups that advocate for prisoners on the inside from the outside.
There are organizations in Louisiana that do that. There are also, you know, some legal offices that do a lot of civil rights work in prisons, represent prisoners pro bono. I don't know if it's, you know, as strong as California, but there are people doing that kind of work there.
How is this shaping your reporting on prisons? How will it shape your reporting on prisons moving forward?
That's hard to say. I mean, you know, it's a reality that, I mean, even if I hadn't done this story with this approach, there's an issue with reporting on prisons in the U.S. of access. It's very hard to get access. Prisons generally, not just private prisons. And if you are somebody who's like a beat reporter who has to go back to these prisons day in and day out, you have to be very careful about not angering the administration that's letting you in, or they cut it off. I mean, this happens all the time. This is not my approach. I mean, if I don't get tours to prisons in the future, I'm okay with that. I accept that. I want to tell the story, you know, as faithfully as I can each time. And, you know, there's plenty of things to write about in the world.
Has CCA agreed to any interviews?
CCA, I reached out to CCA in the process of writing the story and wanted to meet them in person, and they declined, but I sent them over 150 questions by email, and we had a long back and forth by email, and I included their responses in the article. They also contacted us through their lawyers, you know, after they found out that I was working there, and, you know, essentially told Mother Jones that if it published an article by me, then there could be legal consequences.
But that hasn't happened yet.
No, there's
Do you think that they will be more alert from here on out if other reporters try to work as guards or try to get inside the prison?
It's hard to say. I mean, it's a big system. They have over 60 prisons. I do know that I was told by a guard that after I left, the state stepped in and made everyone do fresh background checks. I mean, my background check took about 24 hours when I applied for the job. So, you know, it's hard to say how it's going to impact things going forward.
What are you hearing from other journalists who cover the prison industry?
I've gotten a lot of positive feedback. You know, I think anybody who covers prisons knows how difficult it is. And, you know, you can't cover prisons in the U.S. without being constantly frustrated by the difficulty of getting any information. I've also heard from guards. I've heard, you know, from more than 10 guards around the country since this story came out, and prisoners who are very sympathetic and you know, appreciated the story. I've heard that people are passing around in prisons, guards themselves inside CCA prisons now.
Your colleague at Mother Jones, Madison Polly, just reported a couple days ago that a former guard in San Diego launched a hunger strike to protest the Corrections Corporation of America.
Yeah, yeah. He had been a prison guard, was an Afghan war veteran, and worked for a time for CCA and started a hunger strike, which was surprising to hear. I've never heard of a guard. You normally hear about prisoners hunger striking to protest conditions, so it's interesting to see it coming from a guard.
You know, the other thing is when we talk about prisons and prison reform, a lot of people say people on the left and the right are now talking about this, mm-hmm. but they tend to talk about the money and how expensive this is.
Right.
I don't really hear much about the humanity or the lack of humanity. And just to hear how people are treated and what they have to deal with on a regular basis, the violence, the yelling, the assault, that doesn't get much attention at all.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I want to emphasize that private prisons are a relatively small part of the larger system. It's about 8% of prisoners are in private prisons, and, you know, there are issues that are unique to private prisons that I write about, but there are a lot of problems in the criminal justice system and the prison system in general. And, I mean, ultimately, we have, you know, 2.2 million people behind bars in the United States, and with that high of a number, I mean, that's more than any country in the world, we're always going to have a problem housing people in a way that is humane.
Do you think that that might get more attention, or what will it take to get for that angle to get more attention?
I mean, I think the level, you know, the number of people that we have in prison is something that's being discussed politically now, and I think there is a lot of, you know, agreement on both sides that that is something that should be changed. I mean, and as far as the private prison issue, this in the primary debates, both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have said that if they were elected, they would ban private prisons altogether. So, you know, that issue in and of itself is getting more attention than it has in a long time.
Shane Bauer is a senior reporter with Mother Jones. You can find his piece, My 4 Months as a Private Prison Guard, at yourcallradio.org. Shane, thanks for reporting and thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with the nation's Mark Hertzgard about his new book, Brave Hearts, Whistleblowing in an Age of Snowden. Hertzgard says whistleblowers deserve our attention and understanding for preserving the foundations of a democratic society. So who are some of the most influential whistleblowers of our time, and what does it take to be a whistleblower? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.